Hi, I'm Nathan Ryder, and welcome to the Viva Survivors podcast, where I talk to PhD graduates about their research, their Viva, and life after the PhD. This is episode 62, and today I'm talking to Dr. Richard Leahy, who completed his PhD at the University of Chester earlier this year. Richard's research looks at the evolution of artificial life in the literature of the 19th century. It's really interesting to hear about how he got interested in this research area, and also to hear about how he did his PhD, how he prepared for his Viva, and what happened on the day. It is great to welcome Richard to the podcast for episode 62. Richard, hello.
Hello.
And to begin with, can you tell us a bit about the research that you did for your PhD and how you came to do that?
Yeah, sure. The research is mainly centred around the role of artificial light in the literature of the 19th century. So very specific, but it has to be a PhD. And that I started to get interested in that after thinking about technology in the 19th century. I started to look at things like Frankenstein and thought about electricity. And then that took over my MA dissertation until I started to notice this influx of light and artificial light, more specifically, into the literature of that period. And then I started to think about how many different types of artificial light were introduced at that time, so things like gas light, electric light. And then I started to notice in the books that I was reading that authors were engaging with these new technologies in ways that hadn't really been discussed in any literary criticism of 19th century literature before. So off the back of my MA dissertation, I realised that it could grow into a much more sort of fully formed and fully realised thing and thesis, and that I had much more to say. So after receiving some decent feedback on my MA dissertation from internal and external examiners in Chester, I carried on with the research and discovered that I had a pretty substantial thesis in there somewhere. And for the past 3 years, I've just been working that out.
Okay. So when you say that, I think the word you used was like critics, maybe, like, but this kind of angle hadn't been analysed before. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that a lot of the research that had gone into examining artificial light in that period was very historical. It was very socio-cultural, like looking at the effects of one of the key texts that I used in my research was Chris Otter's Victorian Eye, which is a book that focuses on the political history of such light, so the way that it affected society, the way that it affected people's behaviour. Whereas I was much more interested in representations of it in literature, and my thesis tried to answer whether authors would try to corroborate these historical and contemporary accounts of artificial light, or whether they try to challenge them, and if so, what effect that had on metaphor, on symbolism, and on the nature of their literature.
Okay. Were you looking at any particular genres exclusively for your thesis, or were you trying to be as wide-ranging as possible?
Well, it was a bit of both, really, in that I wanted to show how this idea, the idea that technology, that artificial light could have such an effect on the nature of literature and literary symbolism, I wanted to show how wide-ranging that influence was. So what I did was I decided that each chapter would be focused on one particular light source, but also focused on one particular author or genre or set of authors. So to talk you through it very, very briefly, in the first chapter, yeah, I looked at firelight in the works of Elizabeth Gaskell, because I thought that with firelight you have all of these connotations of industry, of very primal, very ancient ideas of fire and the hearth and reverie and things like that. And I thought that was really interesting to explore the industrial side of it, but also the domestic side of it. And I thought that Elizabeth Gaskell was the ideal candidate to examine for that purpose. The second chapter I found a bit more difficult because that was, in my initial research for my MA, I noticed that candle symbolism was it was multiplicitous. It was very different to firelight symbolism. So I needed something that would really encapsulate how varied the different uses of candlelight was. So I chose to have a look at Wilkie Collins, the Sensation author, and just because his work combines a lot of different strands of like gothic detective fiction, and I thought that the candle that the model of the candle as a literary symbol that I identify could fit into all of them different brackets. So I wanted to keep it concise but also quite varied, so that's why I chose Wilkie Collins. Gaslight chapter was which is the third chapter, was relatively easier in deciding what to focus on, and I focused on Paris, I focused on French literature, and mainly the works of Emile Zola, but with a couple of portrayals of London by Oscar Wilde and Charles Dickens in there as well, just to balance it out and show that this was more than just isolated incidents. This is something that affected a lot of people in similar ways. So Paris, obviously a massive 19th century city known as the City of Light. I couldn't really not focus on Paris. It was too obvious. So I engaged with Emile Zola, and I've got ideas off the back of that I've still not quite fleshed out. So I'm thinking of following those up in future research. And finally, the fourth chapter, the final chapter, was based on electric light, which was, again, a little bit more difficult to be concise yet still varied, because there was such a rapid development of the technology and a rapid evolution of people's perceptions of that technology that I couldn't really focus on one author or genre specifically. So I looked at how electric light became something fantastical in the early years of its development. Like it was praised as a spectacle. It was something science fiction almost, and that was reflected in its use by early pioneers of science fiction like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. And then in the chapter, I chart how that scientific fantasy of the electric light as this all-powerful pervading light suddenly became a bit more real and a little bit more authoritarian in the years prior to World War One. And then I end the study by sort of addressing the issues of light in World War One and deciding that that is where the evolution of 19th century illumination in literature ends, really, because you had things like the blackout, you had a renewed sense of companionship with the candle in terms of gas not being available through rations and things, all sorts of things like that all contributed to this very final stop in the evolution of artificial light in the 19th century. So when I say 19th century, I'm talking long 19th century, but that's about as a potted history of my thesis as you can get.
No, that's really interesting. So, I mean, you mentioned kind of where your interest in this came from. What have been some of the interesting outcomes for you? Because you've given us, like you said, like this potted history of your thesis and sort of the overview. What stands out for you in particular?
I think that the one of the most interesting things is the effect that it had on ideas of interconnectivity. Like, we live now in an age where we're all connected instantly, and like through communications mediums, through entertainment mediums, through heat and lighting mediums. Like, you think about it was only 150 years ago that people were still lighting their houses with candlelights mainly, and then to have that invasiveness of network light coming into houses and seeing the reactions to that, the often sort of pessimistic reactions about the nature of technology, was really interesting. And it was particularly interesting in that it aligns itself quite well with concerns that people have today about the nature of interconnected technology and things like that. It's quite a Marxist idea, that idea of Marxism, the alienation of the individual within the mass. And it is quite interesting to see how those ideas developed and, in effect, are still developing today. As well as that, one of the strangest things that I found out was, and this is possibly one of my favourite stories that I uncovered while researching, was there was a man called Philippe Le Bon, who he worked in Paris, and he was one of the most influential people in implementing gaslights. But he wanted to gain sort of governmental approval for his gaslighting project and gain financing to implement a large-scale gas network in Paris. So he appealed to Napoleon, who was in charge of France at the time, and he said that he couldn't finance it, but he would allow him to light his coronation procession and would sort of take that as an interview and see how the lights worked in his, I think he installed some in the palace as well. But apparently these gas lights ended up destroying and burning Napoleon's collection of merkins. So, yeah, I know. So Le Bon was then assassinated on the night of the coronation, and there's all sorts of urban legends and myths that say Napoleon ordered the contract on his life for destroying his collection of antique merkins. And yeah, it was a bizarre story, but it's one of them little things that I've picked up on throughout, and there's lots of really interesting little things. Another one that's just come to mind is there was an author who he's very recently published a book in the past couple of years called At Day's Close, a man called A. Roger Ekirk. And he through his research, which is in some ways similar to mine, he's found that up until about 150 years ago, prior to the invention and adaptation and sort of installation of artificial lights, people would still sleep in split shifts. So people would go to bed when they came home from work, when it was getting dark, and then they'd wake up in the middle of the night to put their candles on, light their candles, and smoke, drink, play cards, and then go back to sleep. And it's something that's intimately tied to the development of artificial illumination that I would have never expected to uncover. So some of the historical things that I've uncovered, as well as the literary interpretations, have been really, really interesting.
That's an interesting one that you mentioned then about the split shift, because I read about that in the last couple of years. I mean, I've not read a lot of pre-20th century literature, but I mean, I've read like a fair amount of Jane Austen, and I've read a couple of Wilkie Collins, who you mentioned already. And when I heard that, I was thinking, I've never heard any mention of this kind of split shift sleeping.
There's occasional mentions of, I've read Pride and Prejudice recently. I was writing something on Pride and Prejudice and zombies not long ago, so I reread Pride and Prejudice. And yeah, there's quite a few mentions of the first sleep and things like that.
But it's just like unless you know that it's there, it just kind of, you just read past it.
But it's like that with my thesis itself. Like the amount of I'm working with my supervisor at Chester, and she's often said, I was reading this and noticed the use of light. And that's something that also interested me about what I've chose to research, is that a lot of the time this use of light, because it's something so accepted and sort of taken for granted by us, is that we don't notice it. But then when you point it out, it suddenly becomes a lot more interesting and nuanced. And a lot of the times in certain novels, you can chart the use of light throughout, and how it reflects character, how it reflects ideas and themes and atmospheres that the author wants to create.
In the same way, I suppose, like in movies, when something dramatic's happening, there's like a thunderstorm or it's like setting the stage, yeah. Well, that sounds really, really interesting, Richard. Your Viva was only a couple of months ago, wasn't it, in May?
Yeah, Friday, May the 13th.
Well, maybe we'll come back to that in a second then. The date itself. How did you go about preparing for your viva? And I suppose what was going on at the time? Because I know that you're a visiting lecturer at Chester now. Was that something you'd already started prior to finishing your PhD and having your viva?
I've been working as a visiting lecturer at Chester for three full years. Is now, so I started that not long after starting my PhD, which I was really lucky to be able to have those teaching hours in the first year of it, because it's something that I think my research and my teaching have matured alongside each other and given me a real flavour for what academic life involves, and that you have to maintain this teaching profile, but you also have to advance your research and your knowledge and understanding of things. But that was really useful. But as it got towards the viva date, I can remember actually I had quite a busy May. I had my viva on the 13th, and then I was teaching an MA class the following week. So it was a really busy time for me, May. But it was I'm very organized. I can manage my time well. So I was prepared. I'd aimed to get my thesis finished and printed by, my deadline was early March, but I really wanted to get it done and sorted by the end of February. So I managed to do that, and I thought, right, okay, it's viva time now. I've got a couple of months to prepare for it. I'll take a month away from my thesis entirely. I won't even look at the thing. I'll focus on my teaching and all these other extra bits of research that I'll be doing on other things. And I'll just focus on my teaching, and then I'll come back to it in a month and start to revise it, start to think about it, and start to process what might happen in the viva, which was really useful. And I think that was advice given to me by other colleagues from the university who recently completed their PhDs and had their vivas, as well as my supervisor and a couple of people from the postgraduate department at the university. So that enabled me to have a really fresh viewpoint on it when I eventually got back to it. I decided that I'd give myself a month away from it, so sort of like March to April. And I'd spend the majority of April and what I had of May to really focus on what my thesis was trying to say. And I spent quite a while trying to break down my arguments, because I thought if I can express my argument in a sentence or two, then it's solid. It's easily identifiable as an argument. So I tried to do that. I worked with a couple of a couple of guidance sheets that I'd found online with potential questions on it. I organised a mock viva with someone from the postgraduate department and my supervisor at Chester, and that helped a lot. I think that prepared me. Well, it put me at ease, really, because you hear all these stories about vivas and they're the sort of the be all and end all of the PhD process. And that they're big, they're scary. But then I start to hear all these other conflicting reports about how it's wonderful to be able to talk about your research for a few hours with people who have actually read it and are actually interested in it. So that idea helped me a lot, and that was something that was brought through by the mock viva. And there was a series of interviews that had been recorded with people from Chester University who had to go through their viva in the past and had their experiences recorded, and I listened to a few of those, and it put me in a much better mindset going into the viva, as did the mock viva, really, and that it helped me to understand what would happen and put me at ease slightly.
Yeah, and who suggested? Did someone suggest to you that you have a mock viva? Is that just a Is that something that people are recommended regularly at Chester, do you think? Or was this something that, say, just like your supervisor had mentioned?
Yeah, it was made. I think that most people, a lot of the people that I know who've had vivas have had mock vivas, but it was my supervisor, Melissa Fagan from University of Chester, who pushed for the Mock Viper, and who suggested it to me and said it would be really useful. And then we got another lecturer called Eileen Pollard, who used to, I think she does lecture in the English department, but she's more involved in postgraduate stuff and Viver preparation now. And she came in and I forwarded her one of my chapters, and she read the chapter through and asked me some basic questions on it. And I think that prepared me really well.
For people who've listened before, you can actually hear Eileen talk about her Viver on episode 45 of the podcast. What happened on the day then, Richard? How did your Viver start?
Right, okay. Let's have a think.
wow.
Well, the thing is about the Viver, a lot of people, like all of my friends, all my family, my supervisor, Melissa, the moment I came out, they said, how was it? How did it go? What was asked? And I had to say, I don't know. Because while you're in there, everything seems to blur into one, and it does take you a while to unpick it, but I'll try and start at the beginning and think about how it all moved and the process of it.
Or just talk about your general impressions if you like. That's fine too.
Yeah. Well. It was. I can remember feeling quite calm about it beforehand. I can remember feeling as if I knew it had to happen. I knew that I knew my stuff well. I knew my thesis back to front. And I think that's the important thing going into a Viver, is you have to be confident that you know your argument. And you have to be confident that when sort of under the pressure of it's basically an examination, isn't it? So when you're under the pressure of that examination, you have to be calm enough to be able to, you have to be calm enough and know your thesis well enough to be able to find evidence for whatever you're saying. Because you can remember and you can learn things, but if you can't react to what's being said in the Viver, I think that's what's important to prepare for. So know where your evidence is for the different things that you're trying to say. So if you, like, I was really pleased that I could flick to a page in my thesis and know what was there, know what was written. Which was really handy, because when I got, like, as I said, I felt really calm when I before the Viver. I felt quite confident and assured. I thought, right, okay, I know my thesis, I know my thesis inside out. And from my mock Viver, I assumed that the questions would be quite precise, quite clinical, and try to really pick at some key parts of my thesis. But when I got in there, I found that the questions from the examiners were a lot more general than I was expecting. And I'd prepared for that as I'd gone through and I'd read all of the expected questions that people on the internet were suggesting might be part of the Viver. But I was surprised at how general some of the questions were when I was in there. And there were points where I didn't expect the result that I got. I came out with accepted with minor changes, but the questions that they were asking me seemed to be leading towards somewhere more significant changes that were required to the thesis. But I think that was just because of how general some of the questions were, and I think I obviously must have defended them well enough to be able to pass by with minor changes.
Did you feel stressed then during the Viver?
Not really, because as people have said and as I've learned, it was quite it wasn't a nice experience, because it was still, there was still a lot of pressure, there was still a lot of a lot of concentration involved. But I wouldn't say that I ever felt stressed. There were times where I seemed to dislocate myself almost from the moment and become, like, have a sort of a semi out of body experience almost, where I sort of looked at myself. And but I think that's quite a natural thing. Like, it's quite a natural thing to feel like that in an environment like that and in a situation like that. But I think it was just preparing well and ensuring that I knew my thesis totally and could defend it if there were counterpoints discussed, which there were. There were some things that the examiners didn't agree with. But I think the important thing to remember then is that's not them saying that you're wrong. That's them saying that they've got a different perspective on your research. They've got a different interpretation of it, which is fine, really. It's why research exists.
Yeah, I think that's a difficult thing sometimes.
Absolutely.
For people preparing for the Viva and thinking about it, that it's not always going to be a black and white thing of someone's right or wrong. It's just, I have an opinion, and like you were saying, here's my evidence, here's my thinking behind that, and somebody else could have a different opinion.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
Was there anything that surprised you about your Viva? I know you've mentioned that from your mock, you got kind of, I think you used the word clinical, like really like focused questions, and they were more general in the Viva itself. Was there anything else that surprised you?
I think some of the questions were quite surprising. Like there's one question that sticks out to me, which was, okay, where do you see yourself, or where do you situate yourself in your research? Which is quite an open question, and it's something that I'd glossed over when I was preparing for it, and like I'd noticed that it was a commonly asked question, but I didn't quite understand it. But the way that they phrased it in the actual Viva, I started to appreciate it. So where do you situate yourself within this? Where do you see your own views and your own opinions in this? And like I just had to say, like I'm quite liberal, I'm quite left-wing, I'm sure that when I mentioned it before to you about the whole Marxist ideas, I associated that with my own political ideas. And I think the Viva is something that where you've got to know those things before you go in. Like I think that was the one question where I seemed to where I had to think a little bit harder, where I couldn't just refer to my thesis and flick to a page. I had to really engage with it. But in the Viva, they seemed to be really patient. They were very, very accommodating. Like they always, if I ever asked for a couple of minutes to, or a minute or so to think about an answer, they were very appreciative of that and allowed me that. And I think that's something as well that, if I were to give people advice going into Vivas, they are on your side. They will accommodate for you in these situations. They will let you think as they did for me.
Yeah. Well, it sounds overall like it was quite a positive experience then, like those that a lot of people were telling you beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's it was a nice experience. It was a very strange feeling. The worst part about it was because I'd been told that this would happen, but I knew that it was going to be a very intense period of anxiety. But the part where you're sent out of the room and then they discuss your answers and the overall thesis, and then you have to go and sit somewhere else in another room completely for a little bit and until they call you back. I can remember that being the worst part because I knew it had gone well and I knew that I'd probably passed, but I didn't know how much work I'd have to do on top of that or what changes I'd have to make to it. And I think that was the most focused part of not quite dread, but just anxiety that I had on the day. But thankfully, I got called back in for about 15 minutes or so later, and they said that I'd been accepted with minor changes. So, yeah, I was really, really pleased with that.
Excellent. And it's only been, it's not even been quite 2 months yet since you finished your PhD, but what are your plans for the future? Are you going to continue as a visiting lecturer at Chester at the moment?
Yeah, I've had some hours confirmed for next year. I'll be teaching the first years in 2 modules that I previously taught, so that's good, that's positive. In the past week I've had my changes accepted, which is great, which is good news. So the PhD will be off for final binding and printing within the next couple of weeks. So that all the changes there are done, and since then I've just been trying to, like, I've discovered that the PhD isn't necessarily the end, and that it is quite difficult for early stage academics, early career academics, to try and get a foothold on the academic ladder. Like, I've looked for jobs and been turned away from jobs because I haven't got the experience, and I know that that's fine. So what I'm trying to do now is expand my research interests, my writing, my publications, my teaching experience, and just try and put myself in as good a position as possible for the coming few years and any potential jobs, teaching jobs, lecturing jobs that might arise in the future.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. You also mentioned in sort of our correspondence that you're writing a novel. Is that something you can talk a little bit about, or would you prefer not to?
I can talk about it. Yeah, it's something that I've been working on for quite a while, and it's something that I started off and I never thought it would be anything serious, but since starting it, since planning it and writing the first couple of chapters, I've thought, oh, maybe this could become something. So I'm focused on my literary criticism side of things, my teaching side of things at the moment. But I think it's a nice thing to just have on the back burner that I can slowly work on, and hopefully one day it might become something.
But yeah,
at the moment, I'm focused on trying to advance my academic profile.
Yeah, no, I get that. I was only curious because I can kind of empathise with the way you described that thing, because I have kind of like my main business of doing workshops and a little bit of writing and things like that, and I also have like a side business which I've had for nearly a year now of like role playing game publishing.
Oh, fantastic!
And like just really little, really like really really small
that, like,
things.
Dungeons and Dragons and.
So, yeah.
Excellent.
But at the minute, my main interest in that, I probably end up cutting this little bit out, but but it's mainly about interviewing people, because through doing this podcast, I got interested in finding out why people do things. Why are you interested in this or that? And so I've been interviewing people who make role playing games, but again, not people who have like big jobs at big companies, but people who kind of like do it out of their home office, and there's so many time pressures and work pressures and things, and yet there are people who publish a book like every year or even more frequently. So trying to understand how and why they do that.
That's something I'm really interested in as well. There's nothing more interesting than talking to someone who's got a real passion for something and finding out why they do that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As you say, though, there is a financial pressure, time pressure, and this is what getting back to what I was saying about the difficulty of being an early career academic, is that you're expected to do the research, you're expected to cultivate this research portfolio, but you very rarely get paid to write. You very rarely get paid to do anything other than teach, especially with what's happening to visiting lecturers and sort of contract work, contract teaching. That's becoming more and more difficult too. So not only do you have to balance that academic side, which I don't get me wrong, I love and I adore teaching, it's fantastic, but I have to find a job to supplement that while also continuing this research-based work and writing and getting things published. And it is difficult to be able to balance that many balls in the air at the same time.
Yeah.
I think it's just part of it now.
The way you phrase that then, and it, on one hand, it's kind of a funny thing to hear, but it's so true. Like, you have to find a job to support teaching.
Mm.
That's kind of a strange place that we've arrived at, but there'll be a lot of people who'll be in that situation where, you're doing something which has meaning, You know, and it should have like, it's just like, it should have status with it as well. You know, like you teaching and lecturing are important things in society. So it strikes, it's just really odd to me that would have to be something where someone would have to find other work to support doing that.
I understand that the universities are under a lot of pressure at the moment, and I think it's something that's symptomatic not only of universities but also of the job market on a whole, like what with zero hours contracts and things like that, is that I think companies and universities do find it difficult to find the support for people in the situation of a early career academic. And I can't thank my own university enough at Chester. They've been fantastic, supported me through my teaching, through my PhD. They've been absolutely brilliant. But now I think that it's the time where I have to prove to myself that I can do it along with everyone else, and just go into this young career academics field, but with an air of positivity, and not let myself be ground down by money, financial issues, or time issues, and just be positive and keep working towards what I want to achieve, which is sort of to be a respected academic, I suppose.
Yeah, that's not usually where we go on the podcast, but I think that's a really interesting place to almost leave us. I think you've got the right attitude, Richard.
Thank you.
Before we finish, though, can I ask you a couple of questions just to close things off?
Yes. Yeah. Sure.
So the first one is, what advice would you give someone starting a PhD?
Don't be discouraged. It's a long process and a solitary process. But know that there are always people who've been through what you're doing, and they're not you. So you can easily do what other people have done. It's fine. Don't worry about it, basically. Yeah, the other piece of advice would be manage your time well, because if you aren't self-disciplined, self-motivated, as I've said, PhDs are very isolated. The whole process is very solitary. But if you can keep yourself disciplined, motivated, treat it like a job, treat it like a 9-to-5, because it basically is. It's what you've chose to do without getting paid for it, obviously. But it's what you've chose to do. So treat it like a job, and it'll be fine. You'll still have enough time to do things. You'll still have, you'll have to find other work to supplement it. But if you can treat it like a job and think of it as your job, you won't really be that discouraged either, because you'll think that you'll have a purpose, you'll have something to always drive towards.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really good advice. And to finish us off, can I ask you, what advice would you give someone preparing for their Viva?
Think of it as a positive experience. I think that you will hear certain horror stories about people who've struggled on their Vivas or not had a good result after a Viva. Take that on board, acknowledge that that is a possibility, but keep focused, keep confident, and keep positive, because it was a really nice experience to be able to talk about my research to people who cared about it, who had read my thesis inside out, who weren't just getting a second hand interpretation of it. They knew my work, and it's just having a chat at the end of the day about your work, which is great. So don't worry about it. It's an opportunity for you to show what you know, is what I'd say to people.
And I think that's really good advice, and a great place to leave the chat today. So thank you very much, Richard, for coming on today, and all the best for the future.
Yeah, thank you very much, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
That's all for episode 62. Many thanks to Richard for joining me today, and to you for listening. If you've got any questions or comments about this or any other episode, then please get in touch. You can comment directly on the site, viva-survivors.com. You can email podcast@viva-survivors.com. Of course, you can reach out to me on Twitter at Viva Survivors or at Dr. Ryder. And also, please get in touch if you'd like to come on a future episode, whether that's to talk about your Viva experiences or to join me for a special of some sort. It'd be great to hear from you. Check out the site for other resources on Viva preparation, including my books and ebooks. You can find them quite easily on the site. And until next time, I'm Nathan Ryder, and thanks for listening.